I was planning on talking about something that I'm not going to talk about tonight as much, because this morning when I received the wonderful email that some of you received from Santa Fe Vipassana Sangha, their newsletter, I realized that I just wanted to talk about something somewhat different. So I'm going to read it to you because I know that not everybody received it. And I'd like to add our voices to what is voiced in this beautiful message. The Santa Fe Vipassana Sangha acknowledges and shares the pain over the brutal and unnecessary murder of George Floyd. As Buddhist practitioners, we aspire to develop compassion and to practice non-harming so we may skillfully address the roots of suffering embedded in our views. The freedom that the Buddha points to involves acknowledging and responding to the suffering we see around us. Real freedom, wisdom, and love are found in the moments of fearless engagement with life through a mind free of attachment. So this was written by Mark Nunberg from Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis at the heart of the crisis. And as the message from Santa Fe Vipassana Center continues, that we live in a state with a tremendous amount of police killing. In fact, per capita, we have the highest rate in the nation, which is really shocking. So this is not just trouble that's happening somewhere else. It's right in our society, our community here. And so the message is a vision of equality and justice for all people. So now the title I was previously going to teach on that I came up with 2 or 3 weeks ago before this was happening. It feels a little flimsy now. Although when I actually look into it, it's not flimsy at all. It's still really a profound way to work with what we have going on. But I felt like I wanted to, I usually don't like to label my talks or give a title because I just prefer not to, because I might not actually even talk on that when the time comes to it. But I realized this morning, I felt very inspired to change the topic name to "What Would Buddha Do?" And so this is something I use in my life fairly frequently as an inquiry, not to come up with a verbal answer, but to just shift the energy in my mind energetically into a space of openness. Because as soon as I think, what would Buddha do, my mind and my heart open. And actually, I arrived at this because I heard my teacher talk about this. He said that this is a little thing he does. It's like a little skillful means that when he's in a state of mind that feels really difficult, and he will just sometimes say, "What does Buddha do?" And when he first mentioned this, I have to say, I thought, oh, how sweet, but how corny. And then later on that day, or a few days later, I was in a situation where I felt that kind of constriction. And I said, what would Buddha do? And I realized in that moment, it just opened my heart, freed me from the struggle I was engaged in, and changed my perception of the world, changed my perception of what was going on. So I'd like to invite you, if you don't think it's too corny, to just try it. See if it speaks to you. So all of the teachings that we've all been engaged in for a long time, short time or long time, they're all really for times like this, times of crisis, when the going gets really tough. And it's always been like this. It's when we look back in history, there are times of tremendous hardship and turmoil and suffering. And we're in one of these that feels rather unprecedented in my lifetime. Not only do we have a global pandemic that is killing millions of people and causing enormous hardship and financial tremendous difficulty, people losing one another. But we also have a long brewing situation that has just come to the surface again. And hopefully this time it won't just be patted down and forgotten. Hopefully it won't have a backlash that creates more and more violence. So it seems like our aspiration for all of us is how do we awaken this wisdom to which we were born? You know, and when times get tough like this, how do we awaken incredible wisdom and love and compassion and insight so that we don't just become part of the problem and add our fear and our hatred into the mix? Well, it feels like we're being called on to awaken something so deep inside of us. And this isn't a Buddhist thing, this is a human thing. I think this is what has kept us alive as a species, because it seems like we can go either way into tremendous destruction and causing harm. And we can also nurture and foster the deepest parts in our being that give rise to such wisdom and such compassion that heal and that can heal the world. And it's always been like this. So different cultures have different ways of expressing it. But things have been passed down like this for a very, very long time. I love stories about people who are in tremendously difficult circumstances and find their heart. So I saw an acupuncturist a few months ago, and he told me a story about a woman that he met who was in her 90s. I don't think she lived in Santa Fe. I think it was somewhere else. And she was Lithuanian, but had been living in the West for many, many, many decades. And she was a very, very vibrant woman with a tremendously great sense of humor and a real sense of joy. And she told him a story that she was on the first train going to Auschwitz from Lithuania. She was caught. She is a Jewish woman, and she was caught and rounded up and put on the first train to Auschwitz. And she alone, of all the people that she left with, she did survive and went on to have a very rich and deep life with kids and grandkids. And she didn't seem to be suffering from PTSD at all. And so my friend, the acupuncturist, really questioned her about it. And he said, "How did you survive? How did you do it? How did you not get incredibly wounded. And she said, because I never hated anybody. And so she found herself in this horrifying situation, and she didn't hate. And so that freed her to be able to take care of other people in her vicinity and to actually strengthen her capacity for love and compassion and healing. So stories like this I find very, very inspiring. And I just read recently about Viktor Frankl, who was, I think he was German, but I'm not sure. He was a psychologist who was also swept up in this dreadful situation and taken to, I don't know which prison camp it was. Maybe some of you know this story better than I. But he's written about his experience there, and he felt that he survived in ways that he found quite amazing. He said what helped him, and I don't mean just physically survive, I mean emotionally survive. And what helped him was that he used his skill as a therapist to work with the people around him. He worked with their emotions. He worked with them. He gave them love and support, and it nourished him. And in his writings, he wrote about other people in similar situations where they dug deep into their resources and worked for the benefit of other people. And so, you know, it's easy to see when we're talking about love and compassion for others, we're not so self-centered. We are directing it towards other people. But what happens to us too is that we are flooded with those feelings of love and compassion. I'm not saying we should do it so that we're flooded with that. I'm saying let's do it because we so deeply care about others. And when we look at our more recent situation, Martin Luther King and people who were working with him, all the people on the front lines in very, very difficult situations. And right now in our world, all the medical providers, the doctors and nurses and all the staff who are trying to keep people alive in overwhelming, under-supported situations, and the first responses, including the police, you know, who put their own lives at tremendous risk to work for others. So when we look at our own lives, we might feel a little inadequate to the task when we see the incredible bravery that other people are doing on the front line. And I certainly feel that. I wish I was younger. I wish I could go out and be of more help. And you may feel that too. But maybe we can work in simple ways where we could have forbearance to those people in our lives, where if things were easier, we could just criticize and complain and snipe at them. So even that, we could just use it as a way that in our own world, however we can, it may be towards ourselves too, that we can lay down our gripes and our grudges about who we are and actually start to cultivate these seeds of love and kindness and compassion and wisdom. So maybe we can use George Floyd's death and the urgent message of Black Lives Matter, I can't breathe, and contemplate all the people in so many different cultures who are suffering unbearable suffering. So I asked myself, what would the Buddha do? Because there's so much desire to get on the bandwagon of hate and blame and cause more harm. And yet there's so much desire to check out and not do anything. So what is the middle way with this? So what would the Buddha do was what I asked myself with this. And what he did was to nurture these seeds of love, compassion, and wisdom. And he did it by getting to know himself. He turned the lamp of awareness inside. As many of us know, he spent many years practicing as an ascetic in the forest, where he was desperately trying to achieve a high state of realization. But it had nothing to do with compassion. It was all about personal ambition, even though it didn't feel like that to him at the time. But he gave it up. He said, it just doesn't work, and he had to find something different. So he got to know himself, not only how his heart could open, but how his heart closed. He got to know all the dark places, the shadows, the kleshas, the habitual states of mind and the destructive emotions. He got to know them intimately, and he got to know them in a spirit of friendship. So that's what the Buddha did. So as we do our deep journey, let's follow his example, that as we become to know ourselves, we do it in a spirit of friendship. So all of these teachings are deceptively simple, aren't they? Yet it's a really long journey from the head into the heart. Sounds so simple. When I first started hearing these profound teachings and meditating, I thought, oh, this will happen really quickly, easily. And I didn't realize that my mind understood something, but it had not even begun this long journey yet, from my intellectual understanding into the understanding of the heart. I was talking with a friend of mine last week, and he, like so many of us, have heard these teachings over and over again about the opening of the heart, letting the energy drop from the head into the heart. And he thought he had. And you know, maybe he had to some extent, but he said one day, suddenly, he remembered that instruction, and energetically, his awareness moved from his head into his heart, and something shifted in a way that it never ever had before. Something opened, and he saw the world in a different way. His thoughts and opinions that he'd had just a moment before just melted. Everything looked different. Have you had experiences like that? It's the enormous simplicity when the penny drops and you realize, oh, I thought I understood that, but I didn't. Now I do. So I find that the penny drops and then goes back up. And then I have to find my way back in to this understanding where I can let the penny drop again. So this is what we train in. This is what the Buddha did. He trained. He realized that he could enter these states of love, compassion, and wisdom, but they weren't in his being. They were temporary states. Now, we meditators know all our temporary states that feel, where we feel at ease, we feel loving, we feel compassionate. But then it changes, it disappears, and, you know, it doesn't last. So he was really interested in something that could actually transform and shift. So he trained. He trained by just staying put, didn't he? Staying where he was. Not looking for outside resources anymore to give him those temporary experiences. But what could fundamentally change and transform? And as we sit in the middle of our lives, which we're all doing, we have times where we feel intensely vulnerable. And what we do with that vulnerability has huge repercussions. So here's the ear-whispered instructions from the Buddha. Let your vulnerability soften you. Let it be your sacred doorway into wisdom. Feel this soft spot of vulnerability, which is none other than our awakened heart. Just let it be. So our vulnerability is not our enemy, though many of us have spent our lives treating it as such. It's our deepest friend and can show us where we need to be, where we need to enter, where we need to hold our experience in gentle kindness. And letting it touch us and move us, move through us. My experience with this last Sunday, I was taking part in a virtual weekend retreat with my teacher and feeling enormously happy and at ease and at peace. And then something happened where the impact of what was going on in the world, I'd been hearing about it. I hadn't been watching much news. My husband had been telling me about it, but it hadn't really, I was concerned. I felt it to some extent, but the impact of it didn't really hit until this particular time. And then when it hit, I felt overwhelmed with grief and overwhelmed with fear. And I felt a huge, I felt it in my body, in my heart, in my solar plexus. And I felt upset that my peace and happiness had just disappeared. And on some level, not so subtle, I wanted this to go away. But I knew that I couldn't just think it away. It was there and I wanted to let it in. And so I remember lying down on my bed. And then I remembered the instructions of, oh, let this vulnerability be. Feel it. Go into your body. Go where the fear is. Go where the tension is in the somatic way. and let it be, hold it, allow it, and welcome it. And when I'm happy, these teachings are so beautiful to me and so easy. But when I'm reeling with this kind of impact of something that feels so deeply frightening, that the world, will it survive? Will we all survive? I realize this is when these teachings are most needed and we have to remember them. So I'm very grateful I remembered. And then I remember just putting my hands on my body like this and just letting it be and bringing that kind of tenderness to it. And it was still there. My sorrow and sadness and grief was still there, but it lost its panic. It lost that level of anxiety. It was like my heart opened to what I was experiencing, and in doing so, opened to what everybody is experiencing right now. And it felt like an amazing bridge to the world. I didn't feel so separate. So pain will always be with us. We know this. Stuff will happen. We might lose our loved ones. We too will die at some point. Things change. They keep changing. But if we try and avoid this pain, our suffering increases. That's what the Buddha taught. The way to avoid suffering is to open to the fullness of life. And that takes guts, doesn't it? It takes courage. But this is the path. This is called the Noble Path. And we have the benefit now of the incredible work that's being done with science, neuroscience, quantum physics, all of the scientific disciplines, and the incredible Mind and Life Institute that was started by the Dalai Lama about 30 years ago, with some of these incredibly brilliant scientists who were also deep meditators. And the Dalai Lama said to them, "You're so good at mapping what doesn't work. Could you map what does work?" And so thus began this incredible exploration. And I love the fact that scientific inquiry and deep Buddhist wisdom have come together. They're both empirical. They both don't rely on beliefs and dogma. They rely on finding out for ourselves. You know, however powerful the Buddha or any of our teachers are, they can't wake us up. They can just inspire us and give us helpful techniques. But we have to do the deep journey ourselves, just as they have. So a story I recently read about the Mind and Life Institute of mapping these amazingly accomplished meditators, one of whom is a man called Mingyur Rinpoche, who grew up as a boy crippled by anxiety. Even though he was born into very fortunate circumstances with a father who was one of the greatest teachers from the Tibetan tradition in the last century. So he had all of the outer circumstances conducive to his well-being, but his inner circumstances were really not. And he had panic attack after panic attack. And he trained, and he worked. And he became an amazing teacher, an amazing human being. And he was one of the first people to have his brain mapped, you know, hooked up to all these thingies where they could actually say to him things like, go into a state of love. Now go into a state of compassion. And when he would, for instance, go into a state of compassion, he was so deeply attuned to it that it was off the charts. They couldn't actually believe it was happening, but it was. They could see the parts of his brain that lit up with joy and happiness and ease and love. So this man who began with a really scary state of mind ended up being one of these amazing beings on the planet who can actually help enormous numbers of people because of his deep training, his deep longing to help. So it turns out that using difficult circumstances as the path to love, awakening, and joy was not such a bad title for this talk after all. So it seems like it's easy for us meditators to get a little serious, particularly when we start to encounter our shadow, which is so important for us to get to know ourselves in this whole way. But we can go through a period of where we just see, you know, all the shit and forget about the rest. So I think what the Buddha would say here is allow yourselves to be happy. Give yourself permission to feel joy, to feel happiness. Nurture these seeds of happiness. Water these seeds of happiness. These are actually what we need in order to be able to be of help to the world. We don't need to feel guilty for having times of wanting relief, wanting freedom from suffering, wanting to watch Netflix, wanting to do whatever it is that we want to do that might bring us ease. It's the ego that makes it a deadly serious endeavor. And when that begins to lighten up, the ease and the joy and the happiness are natural, they arise, and they can be held equally with the sorrow, the sadness, the longing to alleviate suffering wherever we can, ours and others. So we hold both of these. This is our human capacity. So as we train in allowing for the joy and the happiness and the sorrow and the sadness, we're enlarging our capacity. Just like the people I mentioned in the concentration camps, strengthening their capacity. What the Buddha has been asking us to do. And when I say the Buddha, I'm not just talking about the historical Buddha. I'm talking about all of those who have awoken to this natural state of mind and have passed this wisdom down. And then I'm also talking about our own hearts that know this wisdom when we can rest energetically in our hearts. There's There's something I read recently in Pema Chodron's book, Welcoming the Unwelcome, something that she learned from others and put it in her book, and I found it very helpful, so I'm going to tell you about it. It was first developed by a Soviet psychologist in the 30s, and then more recently developed by an educational group in Boulder, and Pema learned it from them. So imagine three concentric circles, you know, each circle inside the other one. The innermost circle is where we all want to hang out. And it's the comfort zone. We all want that. The problem is when we hang on to it too much, and this is the attachment problem. It's also the aggression problem, because then we want to keep out anything that will interrupt our comfort zone. But it gets a bit stale. You know, those of us who have been born into white privilege, we take it for granted that there's a certain level of comfort in our lives. And that's what this whole world is waking us up to. Could we actually wake up and not so tenaciously hang on to our own comfort at the expense of others? But it's where we like to be, you know. So, but not much learning happens here. You know, we just keep repeating the same old things. So, you know, our habitual states of mind are our usual ways of reacting to things. You know, it's a kind of habitual zone. And then the next circle is where we don't want to be. It's where it's uncomfortable to move out of our comfort zone. It's groundless, it's open. We don't know what's going to happen. Everything is a little uncertain. We can't find much to hang on to. We all know this one too. But this is when we stretch beyond our comfort zone. It's when we begin to lose the stagnation of a closed heart. And then the next circle is the excessive risk zone. It's where it's too much for us. We go into something that is beyond our capacity at that moment to hold, and we tend to shut down. So it's spoken of that there's not as much learning that happens here. But then as we grow our capacity to lean into our discomfort, lean into our lives, it all begins to shift. It's like what would have been the excessive risk zone begins to be something that we can actually lean in. We can just lean in a bit more. And we actually long at some point to meet these challenging situations, because we know it's the only way that we can grow our hearts, grow our wisdom. So we're not doing it as a project, but because it's where our joy is and our happiness and our love. So when we know there are people right now all over the world who are in this high risk zone, our medical providers, our first responders, those on the front lines of social justice, those who are reeling under injustice. We know that they are many times beyond where they can open. So it feels so important for us to know this and understand this and care and give them support. So in terms of what would the Buddha do, he would try and stay in the learning zone and he'd try to keep expanding it so that his nervous system could handle it. That's where he lived, and that's where he taught us to live. Thank goodness somebody dared to tell us the truth. And from the bottom of his heart, he longed that all beings would enjoy happiness and freedom from suffering. And we're the beneficiaries of that. So I'd like to end with a metta practice. And this is one that is common to all schools of Buddhism. And this came straight from the Buddha's mouth to our ears, so to speak. And it's and I think in Vipassana it's called the four Brahma Viharas, and in the Mahayana and Vajrayana lineages it's called the four immeasurables, but it's the same thing. And it's considered that this is how we actually water the seeds of love and wisdom and compassion. Just by this simple turning of our minds towards wishing that all beings, not just some beings, but all beings have happiness and the cause of happiness. And that all beings be free from suffering and the cause of suffering. The ones who are gasping to breathe and are killed, and the one with the knee on the neck. All beings, that's why they're called immeasurable. And may all beings never be separate from the joy that knows no sorrow. And may all beings live in equanimity, free from attachment, hatred, and ignorance. So I will just recite it. If you know it, you might know it with a little bit of a different language, but just recite along. And all right. And let's say it three times. And from the bottom of our hearts, as much as we can, extend this loving kindness, metta prayer out to the whole universe. May all beings have happiness and the cause of happiness. May all beings be free from suffering and the cause of suffering. May all beings never be separate from the joy that knows no sorrow. May all beings live in equanimity, free from attachment, hatred, and ignorance. May all beings have happiness and the cause of happiness. May all beings be free from suffering and the cause of suffering. May all beings never be separate from the joy that knows no sorrow. May all beings live in equanimity, free from attachment, hatred, and ignorance. May all beings have happiness and the cause of happiness. May all beings be free from suffering and the cause of suffering. May all beings never be separate from the joy that knows no sorrow. May all beings live in equanimity, free from attachment, hatred, and ignorance. Thank you. So I would love to open this up to a conversation now. I would love to hear your voices. So I think probably the best is to stay muted until you're going to speak and then unmute yourself. And we'll see how it works. It's quite a big group to have a discussion, but please step into the discomfort of speaking to the group. It would be wonderful for us to all share. Perhaps people could raise their hands. Jenny, if yes. You'd like to talk.
That's a great idea.
Danila.
Hi, thanks for your talk, Jenny. It's good to be here tonight. Appreciated your talk. Definitely was feeling the pain of what's going on in the world. Yeah, and it was, I think, the moment when you were very specific with your language about, you know, the knee and the neck and evoking the visceral reality of Black and brown people's lives that are being stolen was very pivotal for me in the talk. I think that's when I start to really feel the pain and suffering when you hear the names, when you think about, you know, the breath leaving the body. And so thank you for, you know, bringing that close to the heart, because I do think that we have to feel it. And I was sort of debating what I was, you know, going to do this evening, and was feeling the suffering, like, do I listen to the news? And so I was glad that I came and sat and listened to your talk, because sometimes we just kind of need to sit with it. So thank you for addressing that and giving us the tools of metta to, you know, help all beings, or to at least feel them in our heart and hold them in our heart.
Thank you, Danila, for sharing that. I think there are some people on another page that I'm not sure if I've got everybody on one page. So I'm not sure if I will see everybody with a raised hand. And some of you are not, I don't have a picture. So let's just try the free-for-all style for a moment and see if it works, where you do just unmute and speak, because I'm not sure I'm going to see you.
I think we're all on the same page, Jenny.
Oh, really? How come I... Okay. Okay, we are then. Okay. Well, then let's do the hand raise.
There are two pages. So.
Okay.
Yeah, there are two pages.
Yeah. It's confusing because when I look at the other page, it's the same people. We'll just do our best. We're muddling through.
I will speak.
Great.
Let's see. So many things that you said were just really helpful. The whole idea of the Pema Chodron model was very instructive for me about the circles, because I'm in the middle circle and I'm so comfortable and I'm so protected. I'm in a bubble. I've been calling it a bubble. And it's, you know, who wouldn't want to be there? It's just great. And so my job is to really keep myself really open and aware and allow myself to feel the vulnerability that you're talking about in the beginning, and really stay with it, of the incredible unknown, the incredible